Now, there's another way of looking at it, of course, where in states of acute depression, people see it all as meaningless, but not really meaningless. They see it all as a conspiracy of horror. Let's imagine that everything is mechanical. There are no living beings at all. There are a lot of beings that are such good computers that you can't tell the difference between them and what you thought were people. But everything going on is simply clockwork. And there's nobody home, although it puts on a convincing show that there is. So you get the feeling that the entire world is enameled tin, or patent leather, or plastic, and tasteless, hollow, vulgar, like a Wurlitzer jukebox. That's a very common feeling of people who get into acute depression. But you see, there is still here a valuation. You are associating the world with the mechanical as distinct from the organic. And we have a tendency, you see, to put down the mechanical, because obviously a plastic flower doesn't have the scent, doesn't have the soft feeling of a living flower. Oh, they will perfume plastic flowers soon. But you know what it'll do. It'll smell vaguely like soap, and it won't smell like a flower. So it'll be plastic smell. Now, we know that, you see, and so we contrast it with the organic. In what we're doing now, we are getting to a feel of the world that is neither organic nor mechanical. Simply what it is. We don't know the contrast, just as we don't know the contrast voluntary-involuntary, we don't know the contrast organic-mechanical. Neither. So we get to what the Buddhists call tathata, suchness. Tathata, based on the word tat, that, da. Fundamentally, da-da. See? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's what's going on. Well, now this is what happens, you see, in the meditative state. As you are in that, you see everything is da. Da. And you're not saying anymore, well, that doesn't amount to anything. Because you've learned that when people do take you to the place that does amount to something, eventually it all collapses. The price of being taken to the place seriously, you see, where it really does amount to something, this at last is the real thing. The price you pay for that, you see, is the horrors about its opposite. And to the degree that you take that seriously, okay, you pay the price of the horrors. Now that's, as a matter of fact, all. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't take it seriously. I mean, to be specific, you are tremendously in love with someone. And you plan and plan and plan how possibly you can get this person to return your love. And they do. And this is the great event. This is fantastic. But that in the background of your mind is the thought that what if this person should be killed or some terrible thing happen? That always lurks behind the triumph of getting it so, of this intense, gorgeous feeling. Now, if you know that this is, in a way, an illusion, you can allow yourself to take it quite seriously, but always having a Hintergedanke, a reservation, a thought way back, this is the game. And having that, as a matter of fact, you can take it seriously. You can allow yourself to get involved in life to the most ridiculous degree. Because you know it's all right. No, it's just these vibrations. And so, wowee, let's really get into it. That is why a person who might be enlightened, a bodhisattva, does not always present a kind of detached and indifferent attitude, but is perfectly free to allow emotions, attachments. Why, R.H. Blythe, who was a great Zen man, wrote to me once and said, "How are you these days? As for me, I have abandoned Satori altogether, and I'm trying to become as deeply attached as I can to as many people and things as possible." So what I'm pointing out to you is that this basic seeing that it's all da, 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 provides a possibility for you to become involved in it much more incautiously than you normally are. To express feeling, to love, to throw yourself at the mercy of the goings-on, completely, you see? So that this very perception of the illusion makes it possible to live up the illusion. And so if someone, therefore, is always in his attitude to life detached and reserved, it indicates, you see, that there's still a primordial fear of getting involved. And I must say that, you see, I can't understand that very well. I don't understand when people expect that a so-called enlightened person should not need this, that, and the other. It might be beautiful surroundings, it might be the love of the opposite sex, it might be, I don't know what. You shouldn't need that. In other words, you should scrub everything down to basic, basic. And the end of that is, you know, let's scrub the planet, let's get all this disease called life off it and have a nice clean rock. I believe in color. I believe in, if you're going to do anything in the way of the illusory dance, let's live it up. Let's really do it. And let's not be take ourselves so damn seriously that we have to be scrubbed all the time of any kind of ornamentation or frivolity. Oh, hooray. But you see what all this is dependent on? All this is dependent upon being able to get back to the point where it's da, 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 da. Now that's what comes in meditation. Now don't misunderstand me if I say practice in meditation. Don't be in a state of expectation working day after day to improve your meditation. Meditation doesn't like that. You just do it. But it is true that as time goes on, and you are in that state of silence, you will see this quality of the world. Now, the most difficult pains and problems to deal with are those that are monotonous, whereas you can see the possibility of a kind of ecstatic self-abandonment in a catastrophic agony. What really gets people down are those ones that drag on day after day after day after day, like having to lie with bed sores in a very uncomfortable situation, in traction or something of that kind, or just a perennial difficulty that drips, 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 drips like the water torture every day. Now this is the kind of situation in which meditation shows its value. That you are increasingly in a state of consciousness where the world is babbling. Every one of us has something, you know, that we say we don't like to do. Washing dishes, doing accounts. But when you get into the meditation consciousness, you see that nothing is more important than anything else, or less important. There is no way of wasting time. Because what is time for except to be wasted? And you would be, furthermore, you've got you're accustomed now to sitting and doing nothing. I mean, meditation itself is the perfect waste of time.
Out of Your Mind now continues with the next lecture from the Inevitable Ecstasy lecture series.
Now, I want to get down to the simplest possible nitty-gritty of what we've been talking about in a very easy way. To ask ourselves the question, quite fundamentally, what's all the trouble about? In other words, what is your state of mind when you contemplate the possibility of everything becoming nothing? All right, so the universe is a transitory system, like a bubble, like smoke, like foam on the water. And so, how easy? Just go along with it, dissolve. So, what's the problem? Why don't we want to give up? What do we think we're going to get by holding on and by resisting the dissolution? Now, I'm not saying at the moment that, as I'm a sort of preacher, advocating giving up. What I'm interested in for you to feel is what do you really feel like inside at the prospect of there being nothing, of this whole thing being a bubble that dissolves? You see, about death, the reality of approaching death, people are apt to feel chilly, cold, lonely, scared, because it's an unknown. The most frightening thing about death is there might be something beyond it, and you don't know what it is. You remember facing the world as a child, or at any time, the world is full of threats, mostly from other people. And there are monsters. There are all sorts of things which scare you, but beyond every monster is death. Dissolution is the end of it all. And by and large, the art of government is to fill that void beyond death with threats of a rather unspecified nature, so that we can rule people by saying, if you don't do as I tell you, I'll kill you, or you'll kill yourself. And so long as we can be scared of that, and so long as we can be made to think of death as a bad thing, we can be ruled. And that is why no government likes mystics. Because if we define the mystic as the person who is no longer scared of death, because the mystic is, in the simplest possible language, the person who understands that you have to have nothing to have something. So, you can't fundamentally scare the mystic with death. Because, say, well, what end can it all come to? What's all the trouble about? The most it can come to is nothing. I mean, there may be some troubles on the way of resisting this, basically resisting it. I mean, as you might say, the very cells in your body resist their dissolution. And so in this resistance there's an experience called pain, which we've been discussing. But beyond pain is annihilation. Or so it seems, anyway. What will it be like to go to sleep and never wake up? Nobody can think about it. But what is that state when you're teased out of thought? See, get with it. Going to sleep and never waking up. This is not, as you would fantasize it, a state of being in the dark forever. It is not like being buried alive, because then there's an experience of darkness. Now, I remember a little while ago having at one of my seminars a girl who was born blind. And I had the most interesting discussion with her, because she doesn't know what darkness is. The word is absolutely meaningless to her, because she's never seen light. Now, so, when you really think about nothingness, it becomes like what I've often referred to, is how your head looks to your eyes. And behind the eyes, you don't see darkness, do you, right now? You are not aware of a contrast of light here and black there. Behind the visual field, this way, you can't see darkness. There is simply nothing conceivable at all. Neither darkness nor light. See? All right. So, might one venture to say almost that that area of blankness we call death is what lies behind the eyes. In other words, it is what we can't think about that's what's watching. In other words, the farthest we can go in thinking about nothing, you see, we get to the root of the matter. Let me put this in another way. The world is form. Now, you cannot look for the origin of form in form, because what you would get then would be a universe where you couldn't make out any form at all because there was so much of it. It would be like writing a letter on top of a newspaper and then putting a picture over that and then doing something else until there wasn't a single square millimeter of paper left, of blank paper. Nobody could read anything. But one can read, one can see form, one can see the world, simply because there's always emptiness behind it. So you see, in this way, emptiness being the mother of form. And you can always say, yes, only the form is there, that's all that's real. But that is only saying it's all that is figure. What about background? It always has to be there. So let's go on then into our visualization, our imagination. Use your imagination for all it's worth to think yourself into the fact that of this whole sense of importance, of vitality, of aliveness, of being, is simply a sudden experience which was nothing before it started and will be nothing after it's over. That is the simplest possible thing you could believe in. It requires no intellectual effort, nothing. Supposing that's the way it is. Now I repeat, what's your inside feeling about that? Supposing, let's say, you feel sorry. For whom is this sorrow? Who, when it's all over, will there be to feel sorry? You say, I regret now that this thing is going to come to an end. But when it's come to an end, nobody will either regret or be happy about it. That will be that.